Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. You're busy trying to make ends meet, and the news is filled with celebrity gossip, natural and corporate disasters, the latest mass homicides, and dysfunctional politics. How much do you know about the covert wars the U.S. is involved in around the globe? Stay tuned for the next hour, and you'll know a lot more. What begins as an investigation by award-winning journalist Jeremy Scahill into a U.S. night raid gone terribly wrong in a remote corner of Afghanistan quickly transforms into a high-stakes global investigation into the rise of JSOC, that's Joint Special Operations Command, the most secret and elite fighting force in U.S. history. In military jargon, JSOC teams, quote, find, fix, and finish, unquote, their targets, who are selected through a secret process. No target is off limits for the kill list, including U.S. citizens. It's the unbounded, unending war on terror. All bets are off and almost anything goes. We have fundamentally changed the rules of the game and the rules of engagement. Today, drone strikes, night raids, U.S. government-condoned torture occur, and they generate unprecedented civilian casualties. Dirty Wars, the new bestseller by Jeremy Scahill, reveals covert operations unknown to the public and carried out across the globe by men who do not exist on paper and will never appear before Congress, raising questions about freedom and democracy, war and justice, morality and politics. No matter how little you know about these actions, they are being done in your name. Dirty Wars is also a documentary, which will open in theaters June 7th. Here in Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, and media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Jeremy Scahill, national security correspondent for The Nation magazine, has reported from Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Nigeria, Yemen, the former Yugoslavia, and elsewhere across the globe. His work has sparked several congressional investigations and won some of journalism's highest honors. He has twice awarded the prestigious George Polk Award in 1998 for foreign reporting and in 2008 for his book Blackwater. He's the writer with David Riker and producer of the documentary feature film Dirty Wars, which, as I said, opens in theaters in June. Scahill is author of the New York Times bestsellers Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and his latest, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. Welcome, Jeremy Scahill, to Freeform.
It's really an honor to be with you.
Thank you. Now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about, so I gave a brief bio there, but could you, in your own words, briefly tell us the path to the kind of work you're doing today?
Yeah, it's it really, I think, is a bit of an unorthodox story. Both of my parents are nurses, and I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and my dad actually, I was just telling a friend, my dad had wanted to be a priest. We're an Irish Catholic family when he was growing up, and he then met this platinum blonde who was not a natural platinum blonde working in a hospital, and sort of the world changed a lot for my dad's sort of aspirations. Anyway, we grew up in Milwaukee, and I had actually wanted to be a school teacher. I wanted to work in economically disadvantaged areas. I wanted to teach middle school. And I started off going to the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and found out that I was not very good at school myself. So I wanted to be a teacher, but I wasn't very good at being taught.
Being a student.
Yeah, it wasn't that like I was some party kid or something. I was a voracious reader, but I just didn't like the classroom. And I ended up leaving school with the intention of coming back, and I hitchhiked out to Washington, D.C., and I moved into this homeless shelter called the Community for Creative Nonviolence, which was run by Mitch Snyder, who was sort of a famous activist who passed away. But so I arrived at this place, and I was going to work with people who were homeless, and I spent a lot of time taking like veterans to apply for their benefits, and a tremendous number of homeless veterans from the Vietnam War and some from the Korean War, and I ended up listening to a lot of talk radio, right wing, left wing, everything, and I heard this woman on the radio, and she was talking about the rebels who were in the mountains fighting to overthrow the U.S.-backed dictatorship of Mobutu Sese Seko. And I had never heard of Mobutu Sese Seko. I had never heard of, you know, rebels in mountains. I mean, I was not real. I didn't grow up all that political at all. It turns out it was Amy Goodman.
And what year is this?
And this would have been around 96. So it was right when Democracy Now! Started.
Right.
And I basically started to stalk Amy Goodman. I mean, she and I have some good laughs about this now. But, you know, I started off writing. I didn't have email or anything. I started off writing her letters. And then I had come to New York. And I mean, I wasn't writing her creepy letters. I was saying, I want to be a part of that and do it, sort of what you do. And I ended up, I was living in New York and continuing to work with people on the streets. And I would go to events that Amy Goodman would do and come up to her. And I just said, you know, I'll do anything. If you have a dog, I'll walk your dog, or I'll feed your cats, or I'll wash your windows. I want to volunteer on your show. And I thought she had an army of like 400 people working for her or something. So I was
She does now.
Right. That's the Democracy Now! Was very different than it used to be. And I think she had to decide whether to like get a restraining order against me or like let me come in to volunteer. So she let me come in, and I sort of never left. And to this day, I list Democracy Now! On like my social media stuff as my university, because I learned journalism as a trade. I've never taken a journalism class in my life. And, you know, and I started off on the technical side of radio, doing the editing on reel-to-reel tapes, which you know well here.
Yes.
I miss the reel-to-reel tapes. So I started off learning journalism as a trade and had an opportunity to go to Nigeria with Amy in 1998. And that really whet my appetite for wanting to do international reporting. And so what I basically was doing, Amy was paying me out of her own pocket for about a year when I was working on Democracy Now! I think she was paying me something like 20 or 30 bucks a day. I would get up in the morning. I loved it. I mean, it was like one of my favorite moments in life. I would get up, take the train from the Lower East Side of Manhattan up to Times Square to this newsstand that had every newspaper in the world, and I would buy it. And then I would go into, at the time, there was a smoking room at WBAI, and it was old school WBAI, the New York Pacifica station. It was across the street from Madison Square Garden on the 35th floor of this building.
Oh, my God.
And, I mean, it was like at the end of an era. You know, there were these amazing people there. But they had a smoking room, and I would sit in there and chain smoke and write the morning headlines, and Amy was paying me 20, 30 bucks out of her pocket to do it. But I grew up in community media. I mean, KPFK is a very familiar place for me. I've been here many, many times. I love the Pacifica Archives, and you know, it's really, I feel at home sitting here with you.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's the voice of Jeremy Scahill. And now, it's still a long road from writing the headlines every day to, first of all, doing the investigative journalism that you've done for your last two books, and second, writing books that people love reading. So first tell me how you ventured into the investigative journalism, how you got your feet wet, and how you threw yourself into this.
Right. Well, as I said, Amy and I went to Nigeria in 98, and we produced a documentary called Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. And that was really the first time that I'd ever been a part of something where you were directly in confrontation with powerful, very powerful individuals, in this case, a huge oil corporation, Chevron. And I watched how Amy, who is just this sort of fearless character, took to task the heads of Chevron in Nigeria for their involvement in massacring villagers in the Niger Delta who were protesting against the environmental destruction of their community, and sort of watched how she just wouldn't take no for an answer. And then also, we worked for weeks piecing together this piece of investigative journalism. And from then on, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. And I had a chance in 98. I was invited to go on a delegation to Iraq with this group called Voices in the Wilderness. And, you know, young people in particular don't necessarily know this history, but, you know, I cut my teeth in journalism under the last Democratic president, under Clinton. And you know, Iraq was a country that was being targeted economically by the United States through its sanctions policy. And then Clinton had initiated the longest sustained bombing campaign since Vietnam under the guise of the North and South no-fly zones. And so I was invited by a friend of my dad's, actually, who was working with Voices in the Wilderness, named Kathy Kelly, who's been on KPFK many times. And they were going over to Iraq, and they were having trouble finding any journalists that were willing to cover the story. And she said, you know, I know that you're not a really experienced journalist, but would you at all be interested in this? And so I remember scrounging up money and asking, you know, I had an aunt and uncle who I thought were wealthy. I mean, I had no idea. I mean, growing up in a household, you know, with two nurses, I had no concept of how obscenely rich some people are in the world. So they were people that basically had more than a few thousand dollars in a savings account. And I thought that they were rich because they would sometimes pay for all of us to go out for dinner. So I asked them, I thought it was a huge amount of money. I asked them if they would be willing to give me $500. And to me, it felt like asking someone for like their house. And they ended up giving me $500. And then I raised 20, 50, 100 from other people. And Amy gave me some money to get the plane ticket. And so I went to Iraq in 1998, and it was right before the Clinton administration bombed Baghdad in this Operation Desert Fox. And Iraq really changed my life. I mean, I traveled through the hospitals of southern Iraq where kids had these babies were being born with birth defects that didn't exist in medical journals as a result of our use of depleted uranium munitions. And the Iraqis had unintentionally given me a multiple entry visa. It was very difficult to get a visa to Iraq at the time, but they gave me a multiple entry visa. And so I ended up really starting to cover Iraq. But you know, this is before Bush was president, before 9/11, and got to know that country very, very well. And I ended up doing a similar thing, going to cover the bombing of Serbia in 1999, reported on the ground there, and was reporting for, at the time, it was Pacifica Network News and Democracy Now. And I would record interviews. A lot of my reporting, if you go back and listen to it, was really trying to give the microphone to people who lived on the other side of the barrel of the gun of U.S. foreign policy. And, you know, I wasn't doing any investigative reporting. What I was doing was trying to facilitate the stories of people who were being targeted in our bombings or in U.S. bombings or economically, to give them the microphone. And I would file my reports by phone, and I would edit them on this little, little digital recorder. And then I would clamp the headphone over the telephone and then file back the reports. And sometimes I would, you know, you give your narration, then you play a cut, then you give your narration, then you play a cut into the phone. And so I started to sort of become a kind of traveling journalist who, I mean, in retrospect, it was just insane that I would do it. I mean, I would go to a place with less than $1,000 and figure out a way to stay for a month or 6 weeks. And I don't think I ever made more than, I don't know, $14,000 in a year doing this kind of reporting. That would have been a good year. And I ended up living in Yugoslavia and traveling from Yugoslavia to Iraq a lot, working for Free Speech Radio News, or sometimes I would work for German radio. And you know, it was I basically, when young people come up to me and say, you know, I want to do this kind of reporting, what I often say to them is, you know, and I think that this would have been sound advice to give myself, back then. Spend a few months of the year. If you're in a position where you can do this, spend a few months of the year doing a job that doesn't zap your brain. Save up your money, and then go and make a run at it for 2 months. And even if you don't have an employer or no one's sending you, act as though you do, and take yourself seriously, and have the discipline to do it. And so I was doing this in radio, and then I started writing, and I never got paid for any of this. I started writing articles and would send them to Common Dreams or Alternet or, you know, Counterpunch from these places, because I wanted to be a journalist. And if no one was going to pay me to do it, I was going to figure out a way to do it anyway. And I basically, you know, as I learned the craft or learned the trade of journalism, I started to become more interested in actual investigative reporting and digging deeper than just simply trying to facilitate giving voice to people who didn't have one, but actually figure out why are they being targeted? Who are the people that are benefiting from these policies? And it was a journey that took me to New Orleans, where I met Blackwater guys on the streets. And that's how I started writing the Blackwater book, back to Iraq, and then ultimately to Afghanistan and Yemen and Somalia. But it was all very much, it was part of like sort of growing up, you know, it was baby steps.
And you're quite young. Because
I'm 38, but
no, I mean, yeah. I don't mean now. I mean, you're quite young for even that. But I mean, since you drop out of college, you start working with Amy.
Yeah, exactly. I was a kid. I mean, I was this would have been I was like 20, 22 or so.
Yeah.
Or
so like even this point, actually, you're in your mid-20s, and you're teaching yourself as you go.
Right. Well, and I learned from people in community radio. I mean, that was. Really, I mean, I was a radio junkie, and I volunteered for every show at WBAI. I would record pieces for the Cuba show that aired at 3 in the morning, and then I would cut pieces for the weekend show. Anytime anyone would let me do anything, I would do it. And I ended up producing stories for totally for nothing. I mean, like, as all of us do, we all work and volunteer in these radio stations. That's how they're powered. But just saying to people, like, it never was about, like, how can I figure out a career? I loved it. That's what I wanted to do. I lived in that radio station, basically, and that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a reporter.
Wow. To me, your current, what you're doing these days and the success you're having is I would say, one of Pacifica's better products at this point.
Well, I owe a lot to Pacifica. I mean, it was and a lot of people do. I mean, these stations, and that's why it's so important to protect them and to keep them on the air, are in many cases the only community media that exists in various cities, and they're places that give an opportunity to young people who don't have any skills in radio or something to come in and volunteer and learn a trade.
If you've got the passion and you're willing to live that, just you're not sure where the rent comes from next month, maybe.
Yeah, it also is a privileged thing to have that, and I'm aware of that too. I mean, there are a lot of people who are single parents or are keeping afloat many other people other than themselves. So, I mean, I think I was fortunate that this happened to me at a period in life when I didn't have much responsibility and didn't have to think about, you know, where the next check comes from. I was kind of living on couches, basically, and going around. It was what I wanted to do. But I realize also it's from a position of privilege that you're able to do something like that. And I never forget that. I mean, and I'm careful when I talk to people about it, that it's not like, oh, anyone can do this. It's not true. You have to, you know, there's some degree of privilege that you operate with.
There's got to be a bit of a safety net under you to be able to do that. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Jeremy Scahill. We're going to talk about the revelations in his book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. And to learn more, you can go to dirtywars.org and thenation.com because he is a correspondent with The Nation and has a really solid archive there, so you can trace a lot of his work there. And the new book is a Nation book.
It is, yeah, which is great. I mean, what's funny when you do something that has any kind of commercial success, which, I mean, the Blackwater thing was so surreal to me because I really thought I was just going to be selling that book out of a backpack. I mean, I honestly did. I was paid almost nothing to write that book. I almost had to beg them to publish it. I thought I was going to be selling it out of a backpack, but it ended up largely because of community media becoming a sort of underground hit and sold a lot of copies. And then after that, I was getting flooded with offers, huge offers to write books from big corporate publishers. And I mean, I remember one conversation, someone offered me an enormous amount of money and they said, you don't even have to have a specific book in mind. We'll just sign it. I mean, the reason I'm bringing this up is because I believe in independent media and I could have gone down a different path. I was getting offers to also write for like big glossy magazines and so, and I've never done it. I don't do it. And I don't want to do that. I believe in building independent media. So I stayed with Nation Books because I believe in supporting independent press and working with people whose political values track with mine, and so that's why I'm a Nation Books author.
I may have noted, it is the Dirty Wars is the number 5 bestseller in hardcover nonfiction.
I found out about that when you tweeted it. I was kind of blown away by that. I didn't know that, and then I had to fact check it. I was like, is there a typo here?
Am I just promoing?
Right, you're trying to trick people into listening to the show. No, yeah, I was blown away by that. It's very.
And I think you said the highest charting book in Nation Books history.
That is it's amazing.
Very exciting. I do want to talk just a second more about. So one can imagine how you become a reporter doing what you're doing, but writing best-selling books is another challenge. A, you shifted to investigative reporting from just trying to give a voice, but B, setting down to write this one is 500 pages, plus, and Blackwater. When did you know you had the chops for that?
Well, you know, I had been working in radio, and then Democracy Now! Was shifting over to also being TV. And, as much as I love Democracy Now!, I didn't want to be on, I don't want to be on TV as a reporter. I also was feeling like I wanted a challenge beyond radio. And one of the things I loved about radio is that you get to paint a picture that someone else will likely never see. And you have to rely on the power of sounds and your words. And the same is true for good writing. And I remember Naomi Klein is a good friend of mine who wrote, of course, The Shock Doctrine and No Logo and is a rather famous person. But she's a very good friend of mine. And I told her, this was in 2005. I said, I really think I want to try to make a run at writing. And Naomi said, look, I can, I can talk to people at the Nation Institute, which is the nonprofit sort of sister institution of the Nation magazine, and try to get you a fellowship there. But she said, I'm just going to warn you, fellowship is a code word for getting paid a very small amount of money for a lot of work. So just if you and I had, for the first time in my life, I finally had healthcare benefits. I was at Democracy Now! And I got healthcare. And then I'm like, well, I want to go and do writing. So then I leave the comfort of having a job in New York that was, you know, I was able to pay the rent. I had healthcare. And I take a $25,000 before taxes fellowship
with no benefits,
right? And I was just hoping that I didn't get, you know, hurt or something, and ended up starting a relationship with The Nation. And the first story that I did was to go down to New Orleans in the aftermath of the flooding of the city. And on my second day there, I met these guys from Blackwater patrolling the streets of New Orleans with M4 assault rifles, and some of them had just been, you know, deployed in Iraq or Afghanistan. And I traveled around with these guys and then started to ask questions like, how is it that we have armed security guys on the streets of a U.S. city who look like paramilitaries? Isn't this a kind of backdoor subversion of posse comitatus, which, you know, prohibits the military from engaging in law enforcement type activities? And who hired these guys? Well, that was really the first serious piece of investigative journalism that I did. And I found out that they had been hired on a no-bid contract by the Department of Homeland Security, and that they ended up making well over $70 million for their operations there. And they had people spread out from Texas through Louisiana to Alabama. And I discovered that the owner, you always have to ask who benefits, that the owner of that company, this guy Eric Prince, was a major figure in the sort of radical religious right, and that his family had been some among the top fundraisers for the creation of what now are the staple organizations of the religious right, Focus on the Family, you know, and the Family Research Council. People like James Dobson and Gary Bauer got their seed money from Eric Prince's family to start their operations, and they really changed the nature of the Republican Party. That when the radical right, sort of religious right, started to kind of become the dominant player in Republican politics, it was really when a lot of the current policies, the mentality in our country right now, started to take hold. So for me, this was a story not just about one company, but about what was happening in Iraq with war profiteering and unaccountable mercenary forces. You know, they sort of came back and they created like a Baghdad on the bayou, you know, in the U.S. Gulf. They went from the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, to the U.S. Gulf. And I became obsessed with that company and learned how to do FOIA requests, Freedom of Information requests, started to, you know, go to Washington and try to get various Congress people to go on the record, trying to find whistleblowers within the company. And I was, you know, learning as I went and ended up writing a series of articles. And Katrina VandenHeuvel, this is right at the beginning of my fellowship there, Katrina VandenHeuvel, the editor of The Nation, sat me down one day. I'll never forget it because it was like a sort of a transformational moment for me. And she said, look, we really love your work, and we're very excited that you're doing it. But we are a small, poor weekly magazine. We can't publish an article every single week about the same private company. So you either need to like diversify your beat or write a book. And I had never thought of writing a book. And I originally it was just going to be like a collection of the writings from Blackwater. But when I then gave myself the space to really dig into that company, I realized that this was a sort of epic moment in our history, and that people need this information. And I just became very intent on exposing that company, and ended up writing about 500 page book on Blackwater. And that's really how I learned investigative journalism. And I met a lot of guys after the book came out. I would get approached at book events or get emails from guys who were in the Navy SEALs or Delta Force, and they would say, you know, look, I don't really care for your politics, but you're darn right about that company. And I started to meet people who became sources then. And when I would meet them in real life, they would realize that I wasn't this kind of clownish communist that they had imagined in their head. But that, not to say that communists are clowns, but they had a clownish, cartoonish version of who I am.
Who would write this sort
and,
of stuff.
Right. And then they would see me, you know, going after the Bush administration on, you know, Amy's show or on some MSNBC thing. But then, you know, I would meet them in real life and they would, you know, realize that I was very serious about trying to find the truth. And I got to know a lot of those guys and their sources now in this book.
In the new book, in the Dirty Wars book. Sure.
Right. That was my gateway. You know, you were talking about the Joint Special Operations Command, which is called JSOC. You know, people say it like, you know, JSOC. My gateway into that story was from meeting people that some of whom contacted me to tell me how horrible of a person I was. And I just would write them back and say, well, what, you know, why don't we talk about this? And I got to know these guys. Just yesterday, I was I was flying. I flew from Santa Monica Airport to Catalina Island in an old Soviet Yak aircraft with the former senior SEAL sniper, Navy SEAL sniper of the Naval Special Warfare Group, a guy who I've become friends with named Brandon Webb. We have very different views on the world. I've learned a tremendous amount from getting to know him. And so to have stories of SEAL snipers in a book where you're also telling the stories of Afghan civilians or Yemenis who've had their villages blown up by U.S. cruise missiles is what I think is the power of the book. I tried to weave their stories in as one. But, you know, I think for a lot of people, the idea that someone like me would be and he let me fly the plane, too, for a while, which is a little bit scary. You know, that I would be in a two-person plane with a former senior SEAL instructor who trained the snipers on SEAL Team 6 that ended up killing Osama bin Laden. You know, it's for me, that is I'm doing exactly what I want to do, because I think that story of people like him is so important. But so, too, is the story of all of these civilians. And often the story of the civilians is what's left out. And so putting those two together was what I tried to do in the book, and have it read in some form like narrative, nonfiction, with characters
and
plots and twists and things.
So. Very quickly, this phenomenon you're describing, in a way, of people who say, I disagree with your politics, I disagree with your worldview, but you hit it off and you actually how does that happen? What do you think it is about you as a human being and them as a human being, that this other stuff doesn't matter?
That's a challenging question. I mean, I try in my personal life not to be a jerk to anybody. I mean, it's just part of it. I mean, you know, most people aren't jerks, and I think a lot of us make a mistake of pigeonholing someone if we don't actually know them. It's easy to draw a cartoon of someone if you're just seeing them on TV or hearing them on the radio or reading an article by them. But when you're actually sitting face to face with people, there's a very different dynamic. I also grew up in a family where, you know, we're Irish Catholic. One of my uncles was a Chicago cop who was, you know, involved with cracking down on protesters in the 60s, and while my dad was protesting. And I've had to learn how to deal with my Uncle Jim it's the cliche, but at Thanksgiving or Christmas dinner. And also, I think in some ways I've become less of a bullheaded person. I think 10 years ago I wouldn't have been capable of hanging out with someone that, is a Navy SEAL sniper, because I would have been standing in utter judgment of them every second of the time we were around each other, or feeling that I needed to spend every moment confronting them for what they've done. And I've learned a tremendous amount from I've learned more from talking to people that I disagree with over the past years of working on this than I have with people that I agree with.
That makes sense.
It does, but a lot of times we don't do that. Even in our own human, interactions, just on a daily basis. You know, if you're willing to call people your friends, even if you disagree with so much of who they are or what they are, and to actually try to find the humanity in them enough to respect that that's their position, you learn a lot. And so I think part of it is just not being a jerk. And I think part of it, too, is I've been in a lot of these countries, and those guys respect that. They respect the fact that, you know, someone—
You're saying from their side.
From their side, like, it's like they
you've risked your life with less arms than they're carrying—
Yeah. And so it's you know, in this country right now, they're the only people that are really forced on a daily basis to think about these wars are, for the most part, military families. And even if it's from a totally different perspective, there is a common experience that you have with people in the military when you're covering these wars. And you also understand some of what those families are going through. I mean, my mom is terrified when I go to Yemen or Somalia. I mean, I really think that I've taken, you know, at least some hours off of her life, maybe days, or, you know, she alleges years. But, you know, it's stressful when you know that you're...
When you talked about that first thing you did with Amy when you were in your early 20s, I immediately thought of your mom and dad.
Yeah. I mean, they're very supportive, but they're, you know, they're terribly nervous of it. I mean, I remember Amy told me this story about when she went to East Timor for one of the times. And, of course, Amy covered East Timor extensively and was almost killed in East Timor. That she told her mom that she was going on a vacation to some island, near Australia.
Near Bali.
It was Bali. Yeah. But she didn't tell her that she had been going to, that she was going to East Timor, because she didn't want to terrify her. But I have called my mom from airports before, but I always tell her where I'm going. So, yeah.
Okay. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Jeremy Scahill about the revelations in his book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. And you can learn more at dirtywarsoneword.org and thenation.com. So you've begun to answer this question, Jeremy, but how did this book happen? And what did you hope to accomplish with it?
You know, I've had this idea, the first idea I ever had for a book, and I tried to return to it again after I wrote Blackwater, and you know, it's always sort of was in the back of my head. I actually wanted to write a book called The War Party, about the Democratic Party and its foreign policy position, and I, the first time that I thought about writing this book was just prior to the 2004 election, because I was covering the Kerry campaign and monitoring it very closely, and felt that there's this incredible reality that seems to get very little coverage, and that is that on foreign policy issues, the Democrats and Republicans there's very little difference. But looking at the historical roots of why that's true, and confronting this notion that there actually is a markedly different foreign policy approach under Democrats than there is under Republicans, and I've sort of tried, you know, I've tried to write that book a number of times and keep ending up writing a different book in the path. So when I was finished with Blackwater, with the book, I never can quite escape them, but I don't mean that literally. Like,
I know.
Chasing me. I'm just saying it's never far from my. It comes up in the. I was on doing a Spanish language interview once, and I was in Spain, and I was interviewed by CNN Espanol, and I said, you know, that the Blackwater story. I said, you know, I breathe Blackwater, I sleep Blackwater, I drink Blackwater, and it's being translated on the air as me drinking sewage. So I was like, I better never say that again. But the point I was making is I can't quite shake them. I had met all of these guys in that community, in the special ops community, and started to know some people who had worked with the CIA, and was looking into the original story I wanted to do was looking at how there were really two wars in Afghanistan, the conventional war where you see the Marines in Helmand Province and there's embedded journalists, but then there was this other sort of war hidden within it, which is a kind of war of attrition. Where the U.S. is literally trying to just kill its way to victory.
Now, let me just jump into that, because you remind us of the Vietnam War, which was basically waged that way with
yes.
the body count and so on.
If the Phoenix program too, yeah.
If we could kill enough of them that one day everything would flip
right.
and we'd have exhausted them and now it would turn around. And now this is obviously very different, because there we were killing them by the thousands.
Mm.
Here it's more – pick a list of leaders, and if you can kill them,
right?
I mean,
exactly.
That this theory that didn't work when you killed hundreds of thousands now is set to work when you kill a few.
Right. It was based on this sort of bankrupt notion of you know, counterinsurgency, the coin doctrine, that, you know, David Petraeus was the hero that won the Iraq War because of the surge, and I mean, meanwhile, you know, Iraq is in you know, just a bloodbath. There's suicide
as we speak.
And, right, I'm talking about as we speak.
The killings are escalating.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I remember watching the coverage of the hunt for the Tsarnaev kid in the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing. And they were there were all these SWAT teams positioned. It was live on the new local news station, and there were all these SWAT teams positioned outside of the house, and turns out that he wasn't there, and then it turns out he didn't have a weapon or anything, but that's for a different story. But watching that coverage and then seeing in sort of microscopic print on the ticker on the TV, the news ticker, 27 dead in Baghdad cafe blast. And to me, that said a lot about sort of our priorities as
that
a society.
That shot on the
right.
screen.
Yeah. Yeah. I took a picture of it and I put it on Twitter. It was the most retweeted picture that I've ever had on Twitter. I mean, it was thousands and thousands of people from around the world retweeted. And all I said is, you know, that it's that this says a lot about the way we sort of, you know, report on the world, that the aftermath, that the sort of afterthought is the Baghdad blast, which has everything to do with what we did to Iraq, its current condition. So you bring up Vietnam, and I think it's really important. The scale of killing in Vietnam far exceeds the scale of killing today. But what we're doing in the process is we are trying to take out specific people on lists. The lists keep growing. The standards for how you get on the list are getting flimsier and flimsier. And in Afghanistan, the U.S. has basically killed its way down the Taliban commanders and the leadership of the Haqqani network to the point where we're basically killing, you know, farmers in a valley who are fighting us because we're there. And that's the you know, just utter the sort of devastating statement that makes, that when you are killing people just because you're there, you're having to kill people simply because you're there, that you know you've lost. People talk about what's victory. Like, I don't care how, whatever terms you frame your reason for being there, whatever it is, you've lost.
Now, when you say that, because we killed ourselves down the list, in other words, we targeted, okay, if we can knock off these
so
people who we allege are leaders, and we can knock off a certain number of them in certain critical positions, then we'll break the back of
– That's the theory.
And so what you're saying is we've actually done pretty good at going through that list, and where we're left is now killing – why does the list keep growing?
Right. Well, because we keep changing who the enemy is, our definition of the enemy. This is the point I'm getting
because at. Because it turns out that knocking off those critical ones – didn't diminish anything.
Well, my biggest fear, and I definitely have seen evidence to suggest that this is true, my biggest fear is that even if you destroy what has been known as the Al-Qaeda network, you know, they killed Osama bin Laden. No one really likes Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two guy. He's just, you know, he's kind of a second-tier character. You know, you've taken out some of the leaders of Al-Qaeda in East Africa and some Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. In the pursuit of killing these people, we've ended up killing a tremendous number of innocent civilians. What I believe is going to start happening is that you're going to have groups of people that have a legitimate score to settle with the United States that are not going to be organized under the jihadist banner of Al-Qaeda, but are going to have their own localized movements. Or it could just be families of people that plot to try to kill a U.S. ambassador somewhere or decide that they want to blow up a train. I think we've created an asymmetric reality that's going to endure for years.
That the innocents that we kill in pursuit of the ones we claim we mean to kill,
their deaths will inspire new people that wouldn't have been inclined to join
the
terrorist movement.
That's the second reason the list is never ends and grows.
So let's say, I mean, just to put it on a practical level, let's say that you're with a striker brigade in Afghanistan, and you've been hunting down people from the Haqqani network, and you take over a certain village. And you end up chasing these guys back across the border with Pakistan. And you're in this village, and you don't leave. You sort of stay. And then there's some incidents that happen where photographs are taken of women in a courtyard. And the men then think that you're spying on their women, and they start to get mad. And this happens. And then these guys start to say, we want to get the Americans out of here. They're not Taliban guys. They're not terrorists.
They don't have an ideology.
They don't have an ideology. As far as they know, these are the Soviets that are here still. I met people in Afghanistan who thought we were the Soviets. They'd never heard of the United States, which, I mean, that really tells you something.
I've never heard that before, but it makes sense.
92% of Pashtun males in Afghanistan had never heard of 9/11. There was a poll that was conducted. I mean, it's a bit of a dated statistic. I think this was about 2 years ago, but it was 92% of Pashtun males had never heard of 9/11. I found it impossible to believe. I go to Afghanistan and found people that had never heard of the United States. They thought it was still the Soviets. So if you're dealing with just camouflaged men that are in your village and you've never heard of bin Laden and anybody flying airplanes into buildings, if you've never heard that story and you're there and these guys have come in and they were fighting some guys in your village, they've chased them out. Now they're staying. They're using infrared goggles. You think someone's taking pictures of your women. So you get together and you say, let's start ambushing these guys. So then you're attacking them. Well, the Americans are now there, and from their perspective, they're getting attacked by people that they can preemptively say are terrorists. So then they declare, okay, we don't know the name of this cell that's attacking us. Meanwhile, it's just, you know, the Sharafuddin family and their brothers. It's not a cell. It's some guys that don't want you there and are trying to kill you because you're violating their culture. So then you're in a situation where you've now determined that this Sharafuddin tribe, they need to go. And you start hunting for the leadership of the Sharaf. What does that mean? But this is happening all throughout Afghanistan. And the other thing that's happening is that Afghans are settling scores with one another by using our horrible human intelligence system. They know that you only need 3 human intelligence reports to allege that someone is a Taliban commander to result in a U.S. night raid happening. And it happens all the time. So someone's mad that their goats were stolen by somebody's uncle 10 years ago, and they're like, oh, I'm going to take care of him now. So then he gets 2 of his sons to go on 2 different days to tell the Americans that there's this Taliban home somewhere. And then he goes on the 3rd day or 4th day, and he says, you know, I think that there's a suicide bombing being planned there. So then the Americans go out one night, and their plan is to go in and to try to raid the place. They're not going in to try to kill anyone. I mean, that's not the intent. They're going in to try to raid it. And in the process of it, there's rustling on the roof. Someone comes out into the courtyard with their Kalashnikov because they think that they're getting robbed by someone. They fire a shot. They don't know they're shooting at a Navy SEAL. Boom, the whole house is taken down. And it's like, who's in the wrong there? The American soldiers think that they're going into a very dangerous situation. The Afghans in the house believe that someone's trying to violate their home. You know, and the whole thing started because someone tried to, you know, get their neighbor killed or harassed by the Americans. And we're being used like that all across the board in
Afghanistan. That makes so much sense. This reminds me of the last time I had this kind of conversation was with Matthew Ho.
Oh, yeah, who is a person that I've been in a multi-year dialogue with and is a character in my book.
Right, and he is the person
who was former State Department
working
official.
For the State Department and resigned rather than continue, and was the one who said, this is basically a civil war, this is basically modernity versus the past, this is basically rural versus urban, and it plays itself out in the ways that Jeremy Scahill was just describing.
Right. And it's, I mean, but you talked about, you know, Vietnam, and I brought up the term counterinsurgency. You know, we've doubled down on our own failed policies and ideologies in these war zones. And, you know, the level of killing is not what's unprecedented. It's that we're like rake steppers. You know how if you step in your backyard and your foot hits the rake and it comes up and whacks you in the head. We never move the rake from that position, and we always forget where we've put it. And with our foreign policy, there's no new failures. There's only new technology and new years. But it's the same failures over and over and over again. And part of it is hubris, and part of it is that the military is encouraged by Congress to come up with definitions for victories. And body bags, body counts is the metric of the day. Who have you killed in the Al-Qaeda organization? The president himself sort of cowboyishly said once, you know, if the Republicans doubt my resolve, just ask Osama bin Laden and the 22 other leaders that we've taken out. And it's, you know, they're spiking the football. These guys, I think, really believe that what they're doing is decimating these networks. And they have decimated some of them. But what's been the butterfly effect? We don't know yet. You know, remember when people, I mean, I remember getting these emails from people when the Saddam statue was pulled down, because I predicted that Iraq was going to turn into a horrid bloodbath and that there was going to be a massive insurrection against the U.S. And of course, that is what happened. And I had spent a lot of time in Iraq. I could see it coming. Firdaus Square, you know, April 2003, Ahmed Chalabi and his, you know, goons pull down Saddam's statue. I get emails, look at how they love us and they're doing, it's just like what Paul Wolfowitz said. Within a year, there was a massive multi-ethnic, multi-religious uprising against the United States. I think that we just utterly fail to realize that we are not the sort of smartest guys in the room all the time. You know, and
yeah.
That's...
Let me just read you a couple of quotes. This is you, Jeremy. They've killed heads of Al-Qaeda in East Africa twice. They've killed a number three man in Al-Qaeda probably a dozen times. All that's very true. But out of the ashes of all of this could rise a force that is much more difficult to deal with, that is disparate groups of people that have actual scores to settle with the United States. I think we're going to see more asymmetric war in our own country. And I think some of it is going to be inspired by what we've done over these past 10 to 12 years.
Yeah. I mean, I believe that. And, you know, I won't speculate on the motives of the people that set off the bombs at the Boston Marathon. I think we're living in a country right now where there is a not so tiny minority of people who seem to believe that the posse should be rounded up and the pitchforks taken out of storage and the torches lit to go and just hang people before we even present evidence against them. And there's a sort of bloodthirst that sets in, and we have a hyper militarized response to everything. It's not just the, you know, Wayne LaPierre and these goons from the NRA that are playing into this sort of fear rhetoric. It's also very respected members of the Republican Party, like Lindsey Graham and John McCain, who are talking about wanting Americans tried as enemy combatants. I think that we are encouraging acts of terrorism against our country because of our foreign policy. It's not exclusively because of our foreign policy. There are people that want to kill us for their own obnoxious, disgusting reasons, but we're giving people a legitimate reason to want to harm us by drone bombing their country and killing innocent people. It's going to become a reality that there will be terrorism in the United States, I think, on a larger scale than we've seen. And how we respond to that as a nation is going to say a lot about what kind of a country we are.
In other words, if I may, the way we responded to the last big one,
right,
and have continued and as you say, doubled down, is going to lead to more, and I really fear for that, because if civil liberties and the rule of law are so peripheral to how we're behaving now, if another big one happens,
It doesn't even have to be that big. I mean, look at the hysteria when the when the so-called underwear bomber, you know, the guy who failed to set his underpants on fire on Christmas Day 2009, there was this same thing. It's we want him as an enemy combatant, and you know, the school shootings happen. Oh, we have to have weapons in the schools now to to protect the kids. But after 9/11, and we all know this history so well now, look at what Congress did. They give Bush a blank check in the form of what's called the authorization for the use of military force to pursue a borderless war, to hunt down anyone in any way connected to the 9/11 attacks. President Obama continues to use the AUMF to this day.
That's what I was going to say. I bet people do not know that. The justification for what we do in Yemen, what we do in Somalia, what we're doing anywhere in far flung is that same vote that, as we know, so many Democrats have disowned
only
after the
one,
fact.
Only one Democrat, only one person in the entire Congress voted against it.
It was
Barbara Lee.
Oh, Barbara Lee.
Yeah, no, Feingold voted for it. He voted against the Patriot Act. He was the only senator to vote against the Patriot Act. But Barbara Lee was the only one. And I quote her speech in my book because it was a devastating, painful speech to read where she is. I mean, can you imagine in that 1 week after 9/11 being
having the courage to do what she did?
Oh, my God. And she was trembling when she went back and watched it. It was, I mean, she was a pariah for what she did. And she was right.
What I was going to say is that that vote, which in some ways has now we realize was done because of hysteria, because of political calculation, is still being used to expand. Now,
in
what
some
I
cases,
want you
to target people who were toddlers on 9/11,
exactly,
which is to me the most obnoxious aspect.
What I'd like you to talk about, because we don't have time to go into all the details and so on, but basically, I'm going to let you talk about the book you haven't written yet, the one about the Democrats and the Republicans.
I don't know that I'll ever be able to write it.
You know what I'm talking about, is comparing, if you will, what happened or tracing kind of the evolution of what happened under the Bush and what's happened under Obama and where we stand today.
Right. Well, so, you know, so this AUMF is passed in 2001 with enthusiastic Democratic support. And there's been very little work done on Capitol Hill outside of a small circle of people in trying to actually confront the implications of that for our society. The Patriot Act also is another case of that where you know, you have this thing passed that is just an incredible targeting of our civil liberties. And then the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, which President Obama has signed into law that has some very disturbing components of it that seem to indicate that people can be Americans can be detained indefinitely without charge. And, you know, I'm concerned as someone who does talk at times to armed militants that want to attack the United States, which I think journalists should when we're covering this story. I mean, could I get slapped with some allegation that I'm supporting
material
terrorism
support
or whatever? Yeah, I mean, it's I got to know the Al-Laki family very well. Anwar Al-Laki, of course, this American citizen who was killed in a U.S. drone strike in Yemen, and he was involved with all sorts of bad stuff. And I think he said and did things that were reprehensible. To me, it's not about who he is as much as who we are. Like, what do we do with the most reprehensible of our citizens? That's how your society is defined.
And just to say something that you've said many times, it's that they deserve, according to our Constitution,
the
rights to have evidence put forward and defend themselves, and that this entire drone assassination program basically says the president is
judge, jury, and executioner. Right. And it's and you know, we do these things called signature strikes where we don't even know the identities of the people that we're killing. They're called signature strikes. And it basically is, if you live in a certain area of Yemen and you're a male between the ages of 16 and 70, you're a military aged male, and you've had any contact whatsoever with someone who the United States is watching and believes to be a terrorist, and you're with a group of other young men, they will preemptively decide that you are terrorists and kill you. And it's happened repeatedly. It started in Pakistan, and then President Obama gave authority for the CIA to conduct those operations in Yemen. It's a form of sort of pre-crime, except it's not pre-crime because we're not even sure that they're going to commit a crime. So we're intentionally targeting people who are not shooting at our soldiers on a battlefield, whose identities we don't even know, whose names we don't know, and who about whom we have no actual evidence that they're involved with terrorist activity or plotting terrorist attacks.
Basically, it's all based on sort of association.
Exactly. It's like the hallmarks of potential terrorists. And so we're committing these sort of, you know, we've committed ourselves to trying to now preemptively take out people who might one day become something bad. Which is, that's if that you find if that's what you want your policy to be, or if you want the Tsarnaev kid to be sent to Guantanamo, then don't ever start talking again about how America is the sort of shining city on the hill and the beacon of freedom around the world, or is run by the rule of law. Say that you live in a different country. But to directly answer your question, what I think is something that people have slept on that they don't fully understand from Bush to Obama is that even if they repeal the AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, which I think liberals are going to start a campaign and they'll probably win that eventually because I think it'll have mainstream appeal. We love false solutions in our society. Act as though we're doing something when we're really not.
And this is one that you think has the smell of a false solution.
Yeah. I mean, there are even some friends of mine who have shows on MSNBC and stuff. They think that that's a winnable campaign. And it is a winnable campaign because it's not going to actually stop anything.
What makes it winnable.
Right. It makes it winnable is that it's largely a sort of cosmetic thing. But Article 2 of the Constitution, the commander in chief authorities, Cheney and Rumsfeld spent their entire career in government and in the private sector working on putting forward policies that would make the executive branch essentially a dictatorship when it came to foreign policy or national security policy. And they wanted to relegate Congress to basically just funding the operations. Congress could do oversight of the funding and the expenditures, but not of the operations themselves. And they, Cheney thought that Iran-Contra not only wasn't a scandal, but was the model for how the U.S. should conduct its foreign policy. Cheney was a congressman at the time that Iran-Contra happened and wrote the minority report saying this was a great thing and this was a heroic action. Obama, being a constitutional law professor, I think a lot of people thought he's going to try to dismantle that dictatorship of the executive branch stuff and is going to really push back and allow Congress to once again retain the exclusive authority to declare war. And he has not done that at all. He has doubled down on the interpretation of Article 2 being the sort of supreme document giving him authority to wage war around the world. And I think one of the enduring legacies of the Obama presidency is going to be legitimizing and normalizing for a lot of liberals assassination once again, because it has been before in U.S. history, a central part of what's called U.S. national security policy.
And finally, and we've got about three more minutes, how you spent a lot of your time on the ground in Somalia, Yemen, Afghanistan, Pakistan, et cetera, Iraq. But what do you think has happened here at home that has allowed this to take place?
Yeah, that's a powerful question. I sometimes get asked by people, are they going to stick us in FEMA camps? Or, you'll get people that come out of left field with a question about what they think the government is going to do to them. And I mean, we have very real fears in our society of the government invading our privacy, snooping on our emails, getting deep into, our lives, especially if you're organizing around issues that they don't like. I mean, clearly there are risks. But I often say to people, that I remind them of the line in The Usual Suspects, the movie The Usual Suspects, which is great. Kevin Spacey, playing Kaiser Sose and the whole. But he says the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist. And in a way, there's already been a coup of sorts in the United States. And the coup has been that we've been convinced that we actually are free. And that we do pose a threat. We, those of us that are speaking out, we don't actually pose much of a threat at all to the powerful. They, you don't need fat guys and cigars behind the scenes telling media outlets what to report anymore. Journalists are pretty much lockstep with the powerful anyway. They hang out together. That's their sort of the culture around them. I think we as a society have been gripped by fear. I think we've been sold a bill of goods that Al-Qaeda represents some kind of existential threat to us. It's not that there aren't people that want to take down airplanes. It's that is not even a fraction of the threat that we face in this country from our own gun violence or traffic accidents.
Unregulated fertilizer factories.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think part of it is that we've been gripped by fear. I also think that when people are struggling economically, how can you ask someone, a mother of three, who's working a couple of jobs and is trying to figure out a way to get all of her kids to and from school every day and make sure they're doing the homework? How can we ask her to care about a drone strike in Yemen?
That very thing I said at the very top of the introduction.
I have total sympathy for that position. It's a tough ask. But I do think if we don't, those of us, particularly those of us that have the freedom to do this, if we don't take this on as our issue, it's going to come back around to haunt us. We will look back in decades, I think, and say, wow, we were asleep at the wheel when the popular Democratic constitution law professor, Nobel Peace Prize winner, solidified all of these things that we were so against when Republicans were doing it. And to me, that's a chilling admission. I think that's a challenge for all of us.
And if you were finally 30 seconds, what would you tell listeners to do?
I mean, I think we need to wage our own hearts and minds campaign. I think there should be a moratorium on drone strikes. Even if you think that they're a smarter way of waging war, which I don't, George Ryan abolished the death penalty in Illinois because of the evidence that so many innocent people have been put to death. We need to have a moratorium on the drone strikes and see who's actually been killed. And I believe that if the American people were presented with the names and who these people really were, there would not be support for that policy. And so that I think that's something people can actually call on their elected representatives to do. Say, I want to know who we're killing in these wars.
Okay, very good. Again, the book is Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. To learn more, go to dirtywars.org and thenation.com. Thank you to Jeremy Scahill. Keep up the good work.
Honored to be with you.
For this week's conversation and many others, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, to the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Free Forum Podcast on iTunes. This program is going to be archived for the next 90 days at kpfk.org. Check audio archives and scroll down by date and time. Thanks to G, my engineer, and Stan Mizrahi in production. To you, my listeners, I look forward to being with you again next week.